next on Think, the genius of Kendrick Lamar.
He's not going to do what everybody else is doing from a production standpoint. He's trying to build worlds. He's a world builder in his music, whereas other rappers may just collect a bunch of beats, rap on the beats, put it out and call it an album. And that's what people were doing at the time of his ascendance. He decides he wants to create these sort of cohesive statements that you can revisit decades later.
This hour, we'll talk with music journalist Marcus Moore about the Compton-born rapper, his rise to fame, and how he became a voice for the voiceless in the wake of the Black Lives Matter movement. That's after a short break. In the early 1980s, Chicago native Kenny Duckworth moved to California with $500 in his pocket, wanting to escape the gang violence that plagued his city. He moved to Compton, once a place of prosperity, but by the 80s, it too was riddled with the same violence Duckworth was trying to leave behind. In Compton, Anthony Tiffith was the oldest of seven. At that time, the only way to protect yourself from gang violence was to join one, which Anthony did as a young boy. He lost his cousin to the bloodshed, but Anthony kept going. Years later, the two would meet. Kenny was working at a KFC to provide for his wife and son, who used to watch his father flipping chicken in the back. Anthony walked into the same restaurant, intent on robbing it. But when he met Kenny, he decided not to. He'd robbed it before, but something was different. Kenny offered him free chicken and extra biscuits whenever he'd come in. Years passed, and the two would meet again in a recording studio. Both Anthony and Kenny watched as the boy in the back of that KFC became a voice of his generation. His name? Kendrick Lamar. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Lamar tells this story in the song Duckworth from his Pulitzer Prize-winning album Damn. In that same body of work, he examines his insecurities, mortality, and the luck that played into his own existence. What if Tiffith had shot his father? Where would he be? Veteran music critic and journalist Marcus Moore wanted to pull back the curtain on the somewhat elusive artist. He's written the first cultural biography of Lamar. It's called The Butterfly Effect: How Kendrick Lamar Ignited the Soul of Black America. Marcus, welcome to Think.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
There was not necessarily anything about the early years of Kendrick Lamar Duckworth that told the world he was a legend in the making. What do friends say he was like as a kid?
He was just like any other kid. He liked playing basketball. He liked playing football. He just liked doing kids' things. And a lot of friends tell me that, you know, he was always a very cerebral type of person. Even as he was playing, you know, sports and hanging out with friends and things like that, he also took an interest in creative writing. He was also always a very brooding character. He always sort of stayed off to himself because up until he was 7 years old, he was an only child. Everybody would say that he essentially, they could see greatness in him from a young age, but there was nothing about him that said, oh, he's about to be the greatest rapper of his generation. The main thing that everybody says, whether it's his childhood friends or his collaborators, they all say that he had an intense work ethic and he worked to be the best.
Parents were from Chicago. How did they find their way to Southern California before he was born?
They literally packed a couple of bags and took about $500 and drove from Southside Chicago to Compton. They were actually going somewhere further, but they landed in Compton. And honestly, it came from a mandate from Kendrick's mom, you know, before he was born, obviously, but it came from a mandate that from Paula that her husband can't be in the streets anymore. You know, he can't be participating in gang activity. So she gave him an ultimatum, and then they packed up and they left. And that's essentially how it happened. They had $500 between them, and they stayed with Paula's sister, Kendrick's aunt, and then they eventually got on their feet.
All right, I want to talk about how little Kendrick Lamar Duckworth found his way to writing as an outlet. He had this really influential teacher in middle school.
Yes, Mr. Inge, Reggie Inge. Kendrick still thinks the world of Mr. Inge. He still considers him a mentor and a creative writing teacher and so many things. And he was the one guy who taught him about the written word at first. It was in seventh grade. At the time, there was a there was a fight. It was a gang war, rather, in a county jail between blacks and Latinos that eventually spilled into the school system, you know, so the kids sort of carried around that same sort of tension. And one day, Mr. Inge decided, okay, I have to find a way to get these kids to, you know, express their anger and get this anger out, because they were ready to fight. His direct quote was, they were ready to fight at 7:30 in the morning. And Kendrick really took to that, because again, like I was saying at the top, he was a very brooding character, you know, was a very isolated child and things like that. But he was walking around with a lot of different emotion that he didn't know how to express. And through this class, he learned how to express his emotion, not just his anger, but you know, his happiness, his joy, his depression, you know, whatever he was feeling at the time. And he took to that class and he just stuck with it. And that's the main thing I wanted to sort of highlight in the book, is that yes, you know, we look at him now as a great rapper, a great performer, Pulitzer Prize winner, but he's a guy, and back then he was a kid that was just an incredibly hard worker, and he wanted to work as hard as possible to get as great as possible. And so he has Mr. Inge to thank for all of that.
Yeah, Reggie Inge was not easy on Kendrick, despite his talent, and it sounds like Kendrick has never been easy on himself.
No, not at all. Not even to this day, you know, because you know, even now, he obviously the spotlight is at its brightest point. So, you know, he knows who he is, and he knows that he can't come out with anything that's mediocre by his standards. And that all started with Mr. Inge, where he wasn't hard on him to the point where it was an adversarial relationship, but at the same time, Mr. Inge would, you know, it would be a good paper, but he would still be like, okay, well, maybe move this here, maybe move that part there, always editing. And so he was hard on himself. And then at the same time, when Kendrick started rapping, when he started to carve out a professional career, he linked up with this guy named Anthony Tivis, AKA Top Dog, who was the same way, where it's like, yeah, you're good, but I'm not going to show you how much I think you're good. I'm going to, you know, make it hard on you. I'm gonna, you know, only give you a couple of bucks for this meal, and we're gonna really grind out. And so I would say the two most seminal figures in his life are Mr. Inge and Mr. Tiffith, along with his dad, obviously, who taught him the value of hard work and never settling for anything that's not perfect.
His working relationship with Anthony Tiffith, Top Dog, is also kind of an interesting twist of fate, isn't it?
It's it's a sort of a long winding story, but it's still an interesting one, where, you know, obviously Kendrick decided when he was in middle school that he wanted to rap, you know, that he wanted to rap full time. And so he was rapping, you know, obviously, you know, getting better. He was you know, rapping the different instrumentals he heard, and either rapping a cappella, things like that. And so that led him to a hip hop showcase. I forget the year. I want to say it was like early 2000s, where, you know, he's in this rap showcase. He's there, and there's this producer there who was doing the beats for a lot of the rappers. This guy named Sound. He came to be known as Soundwave. Also a very, you know, talented producer in his own right these days. And so they linked, and they hit it off right away. And so, you know, they kind of lost contact. And one day, Soundwave is at Top Dog's house, and he walks in and he sees Kendrick sitting on the couch. And he's like, oh, wait, you know, that's the kid from that rap battle. And so he tells Top Dog, don't let him leave. Like, do not let this guy leave. You gotta sign him, do whatever you gotta do. Just don't let him walk out the door. And so, you know, obviously, in Top Dog and its infinite wisdom, he decides, okay, I'm gonna give you a shot. But I'm gonna make it hard on you. I'm gonna put on all these double time beats. I'm gonna put on these crazy instrumentals that really nobody can rap to, and let's see how you do. And Kendrick, you know, he throws on the music, and Kendrick does great. And you know, even when he throws on these different beats that switch up in the middle, and they have these different swings to them, Kendrick never misses a step. And that's sort of how they linked up. You know, I want to say that was 2004, 2005. And he never left, you know, he never left Top Dog's house. And those were essentially the beginnings of his work with TDE. Vigilante K dot, feel antsy when I jump in the booth. Top Dog lick two shots, cameras off. This is pay-per-view, city of Compton bound. Your fraternity die instantly on my stomping grounds. Cold at the streets, time for an hour.
So Kendrick started performing using a persona. Talk about the sort of character that K-Dot was and what K-Dot's relationship was to the actual person, Kendrick.
Yeah. K-Dot was essentially, he was a character. You know, he was an alter ego, not unlike Jay-Z, not unlike Lil Wayne. Essentially, you know, a lot of rappers where they have their birth names and then they create a persona and rap underneath the persona. And so it was the same thing. You know, Kendrick decides, like a lot of kids, that, oh, I want to be a rapper. But in the early days, he's just rapping for the sake of rapping. So he's rapping about how great he is. He's rapping about how he's going to be a superstar. It was all about him being clever and being seen, because at the time he was a huge fan of Jay-Z's and Lil Wayne's. And so when you listen to those early mixtapes, you can hear a very clear influence. You can even hear on that very first mixtape that Kendrick took a lot of Jay-Z instrumentals and just rapped on top of them. And, you know, I think he did one project in particular that was dedicated directly to Lil Wayne. So K-Dot essentially was him as a lyricist, just trying to be as clever as possible. So those were the early days. And it wasn't until he starts rapping under his name, Kendrick, his first and middle name, Kendrick Lamar, that he decides that, okay, you know, I'm going to start telling my story. And that those were the beginnings of the Kendrick Lamar that we know today.
Yeah, I love the line in the book. You say the thing that was missing from Kendrick's flow as K-Dot was Kendrick himself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And even he would admit that. It's like, there's nothing wrong with rapping for the sake of rapping. You know, we have a lot of legendary MCs who would do that. But quite honestly, that's not the way to sustain yourself long term. Like, you'll put out some good records, you know, just rapping because you're clever. But these aren't records that we can come back to. More than likely, we're not going to be able to come back to them 20 years later. And so Kendrick, you know, obviously had a lot to talk about. He was growing up in Compton, and his family had a very checkered history with gang activity and being in and out of jail and things like that. So he just decides to start rapping about that, because in his way, he's like, well, no one can tell my story better than me. And so I'm just going to put it all out there and be honest. And, that was the missing part from his music, was the fact that he was talking about something that you can go back to a decade, two decades later.
Kendrick's father, Kenny Duckworth, said to him at one point, Duckworth had been involved in gangs and some criminal activity, and he said to his son, I don't want you to end up like me, to be like me. I mean, a lot of parents say that to their kids and hope for the best, but the kids don't necessarily absorb it. It sounds like this was a moment that really stuck with Kendrick Lamar.
Yeah, it did. It did. It really stuck with him because... I mean, obviously he loved his father. He still loves his father. And, you know, like a lot of boys, you want to grow up to be like your dad. And obviously Kendrick as a kid didn't know everything that his father was doing when he left the house. So it wasn't until that moment that you just outlined, you know, where he was like, oh, I don't want you to grow up and be like me, that it really sunk in for Kendrick that, okay, I need to do something different. I want to be a different person. You know, obviously he's still influenced by his dad and probably still has some of his same traits, but professionally he wanted to be something else and he wanted to follow his own path. And that's the thing that's always made Kendrick stand out. He's always been a guy who marched to the beat of his own drum. And that also comes with the support of his father, you know, because his father knew how great he was. And that he had the potential to be seen on TV and to be seen, you know, his music video can be right beside the greats. And that's exactly what his father was pushing for. And when he said that line, that was almost a doubling down to say, don't be like me, be better than me, you know, do something different. And I think that's something that Kendrick always, he never let it go. He always took that to heart.
My guest is Marcus Moore, music journalist, editor, curator, and pop culture commentator. He's the author of The Butterfly Effect, How Kendrick Lamar Ignited the Soul of Black America. We'll be back after a short break. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Marcus Moore, music journalist, editor, curator, and pop culture commentator. He's the author of The Butterfly Effect, How Kendrick Lamar Ignited the Soul of Black America.
You're a writer yourself. Obviously, you've spent your career finding ways to use words to their most powerful effect. So I'm curious, what is it about Kendrick Lamar's lyrics that makes them transcendent? Like, how does he use language in ways that even his most celebrated contemporaries can't quite touch?
I think it's in the way he has this really fascinating way of letting his words land in different places on the beat. Meaning, when I hear Kendrick Lamar, I hear somebody like, I hear Andre 3000 from Outkast. One for the money, yes sir, two for the show. A couple of years ago on here, the end. I hear some Rakim from the 80s, you know. The Rakim in your ear, then the hysterical that makes Erico get an ad time to whack. So the lyrical format is pure, your face is a death for me. You know, and just people who you can tell were influenced by jazz music, you know, and any jazz head can tell you the notes are never going to land the same way each time. You know, every take is going to be different. And that's the thing that makes him stand out. And that's the thing that a lot of his collaborators told me, is that he's essentially a jazz musician. He tries to convey his words in the same way that John Coltrane would play his saxophone, you know, where he's trying to use it to sort of ascend to a higher place. And I think more than anything, he's a very visual rapper, you know, like, and I think that's why a lot of people hold Good Kid, Mad City, his studio debut album, in the highest regard, because it's a very visual record. You can see everything happening. And so I feel like lyrically, that's what makes him stand out. But I think the secret sauce to Kendrick also is musically. You know, I think that he's not going to do what everybody else is doing from a production standpoint. He's trying to build worlds. He's a world builder in his music, whereas other rappers may just collect a bunch of beats, rap on the beats, put it out and call it an album. And that's what people were doing at the time of his ascendance. He decides he wants to create these sort of cohesive statements that you can revisit decades later. And so I think when you put all of those things together, the lyrics with his beat selection, with his abilities as a producer, it all equals this great MC that obviously, you know, books are being written about him now.
What was he contemplating in the songs on Good Kid, Mad City, which was his major label debut?
He was essentially telling his story. He was contemplating his growing up in Compton, even mundane things. He was essentially giving a day in the life of a Compton kid, and not the NWA version of Compton. He was giving the good and the bad. He was talking about little things like, you know, like teenage boys, like, you know, going over to a girl's house, or, you know, or him and his friends are riding down the freeway just doing nothing in particular. Going to houses. Now, the one thing I will say that makes him stand out on Good Kid, Mad City, he essentially shouted out his friends for keeping him on the right path, hence the term Good Kid in a Mad City, where, he bumped his head a couple of times. And there was like one time in particular, there was this home invasion. Obviously, nobody was there, but they just kind of go in this house and, you know, try to grab anything that they can. But more than anything else on Good Kid, it was him giving the full scope of what a Compton kid goes through. And I think that's what resonates, because it's not just a Compton story. Like, even when the album came out and me re-listening to it, I realized a lot of the stuff that he was going through or that he was doing, I was doing the same thing in Landover, Maryland.
I'm really curious about how an introvert gains the confidence as a performer to sort of own the stage or the recording studio so that he's getting calls out of the blue from Dr. Dre. How did he develop as a presence in front of the microphone and on stage?
Practice, hard work. That's essentially it. I know it may sound like a cliche, but I can assure you that's exactly what it was for him. And the same thing with me. It's like Kendrick was never a dude who's like, okay, I'm gonna come out. And when he was K-Dot, he was under the impression that, okay, all I need is this one song. I'm gonna come out with this mixtape and it's gonna blow up and I'm gonna be a big star. But it wasn't until he fully linked up with TDE and they started going on the road that he realized that he needed to put in some work. You know, he's a real big basketball fan. And so every time I think about Kendrick Lamar, I think about somebody like Kobe Bryant, you know, same person where when he came into the league, he was still the guy who shot like four air balls at the end of the game. Right. But then he just put in the work, you know, he put more shots up and he did more work and became an all-time great. And so it was the same thing with Kendrick, where he was going out on the road in those early days with J-Rock, who was primed to be the first star of TDE. He was going out with J-Rock. He was studying from people like Tech N9ne and Richie Abbott. Everything, the ins and outs of how to hold a microphone, what to wear on stage, how to operate backstage. And it was just repetition. It was those 10,000 hours that Malcolm Gladwell talks about where, you know, in the beginning, you're not going to know what you're doing. But if you keep doing it over and over and you just always put hard work into your craft, eventually you're going to be an expert. And that's what happened with him, where, you know, when he was on stage in particular, it provided him an outlet to be a totally different person, even though he was still rapping under his birth name. It gave him an outlet to talk about these things that he couldn't talk about fully in a classroom or at home or on the street. You know, he wanted to tell his story to a lot of people.
So since he was, you know, 14 or 15, it's very clear here that he's one of these guys who is basically always working, right? Always looking ahead to the next thing and how it can be better than the thing he's just produced. I mean, that kind of restlessness clearly can propel someone's development as an artist. It can also leave somebody feeling pretty hollow emotionally.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's a very fair statement. And I think it's something that all of us restless creatives work with, you know, that we struggle with rather is, you know, yes, I'm putting in this work and I want to be great, but if you don't have balance, then you don't really have anything because nothing will ever be good enough. You know, if you're a perfectionist, it doesn't matter if you come out with A Good Kid or To Pimp a Butterfly or, you know, Section 80 or anything, you're always going to work to top it. And I think that's part of the reason why he is so silent now in between records is that he just kind of has to get away and do something different and not do anything musically, you know, and not pay attention to what's going on social media and what people are saying about him. So yeah, something like that can definitely make you feel hollow because you don't feel like you're seen. Even though all of these people are saying how great you are and they're talking about how great your music is and your art is, it still isn't enough because you're always pushing for that next thing. You're always pushing for that next project to be even better.
He went to South Africa on tour in, 2013, 2014? What made that such a momentous trip for him? Like, what did he discover about the possibilities of Black existence that he wasn't able to fully comprehend in the U.S.?
Well, it's like any Black kids in U.S. school systems are not taught about Africa. We're only taught about, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King. That's what they always tell us about. They don't tell us anything about the true wonders of the continent. He grew up the same way. You know, he grows up in the Compton School District where he's getting a standard education, the same education that all us young Black kids get. And so he doesn't really have a concept of Africa. I mean, he knows of it, obviously, but he doesn't know that it's a place with all of this grand beauty and elegance and culture. And so he goes there on tour. You know, he got booked to do three gigs in South Africa. And so in between those shows, he decides that he needs to see what's going on outside of these gigs. He needs to walk through Joburg. He needs to walk through Cape Town and Durban. And that spawned this awakening. He's in contact with Soundwave, his main producer. And he's just like, man, I wish you could see the things that I'm seeing. And I wish all the homies from Compton could see this. This is, they don't teach us this. And so I feel that his trip to South Africa essentially changes the landscape of modern music, because without that trip to South Africa, he doesn't have the worldly perspective needed to create To Pimp a Butterfly, which in my opinion is his best record, but it's definitely a groundbreaking record that changed the landscape of music. You know, it sort of shifted the sound and the topic. You want to love like Nelson, you want to be like Nelson, you want to walk in his shoes, but your peacemaker seldom. You want to be remembered and deliver the message that considered the blessing of South Africa. Overall was just one of these places where he could feel like he could be himself. He's seeing all of these different black faces, and he's in this majority black country. You know, on one side, there are people who are, you know, they're prospering. They're doing great things. They're not really worried about what's going on in westernized cultures. But at the same time, he also sees the slums. And then that sort of locks in form that, okay, I thought that we were going through some things in Compton, but there's nothing like what's going on here. Like, their problems are way harder than ours, but they're not as angry as we are in the States, because racism is just so inbred in the United States. You just feel it from a young age. So that's when he decides to create a record that's essentially dedicated to South Africa. And that's the overall perspective that he gained there pretty much shifted the cultural landscape musically in the States.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd.
I'm thinking even about the visual influence of his time there in that performance he did, really amazing performance for the Grammys in 2016.
That was easily one of the best performances of all time of any genre.
Can you describe for people what happened there? I hope they will Google it after you and I talk, but just for the moment, talk about the sort of surprise of that performance.
It was very stark visually, because the performance also happened at a time when outside of LA and, you know, throughout the streets, throughout the world even, you had the rise of Black Lives Matter, and you had unarmed black people being essentially murdered by police at an alarming clip. You know, I mean, obviously that's always been an issue, but for the first time, at least in this generation, folks could see it on a continuous loop, you know, with social media and the 24-hour news cycle. So you have all that going on outside, and Kendrick decides to bring that into the 2016 performance, especially with the opening where he's the leader of a chain gang that's going up to a microphone. And the thing that I love most about that performance was his use of sound and silence. Like, when he first walks up there, you hear a little bit of music in the background. You know, I remember specifically Terrace Martin playing his saxophone in a jail cell to Kendrick's left. But he drops the sound out, and all you hear are chains like rattling against the microphone. And I remember that like very prominently. You know, I think that sort of set the mood for what was going to go on. And so from there, he gives us the full scope of blackness, essentially, where he performs the Black of the Berry while still in a prison uniform as part of the chain gang. I'm African American. I'm African. I'm black as the moon. Heritage of a small village, part of my residence. Came from the bottom of mankind. My hair is nappy. You know that it's big. My nose is rounded wide. You hate me, don't you? You hate my people. Your plan is to terminate my culture. You know you're evil. But then it blossoms out into African dance, and then in the end, he performs a medley of unreleased music. That culminates in behind him is this big white silhouette of the continent of Africa. And right in the middle of it, it says Compton. And I think that says everything. I think that that essentially, it breaks down Kendrick to a T, you know, at least the new Kendrick, you know, the guy who he went to South Africa and it changed his life, but Compton still is his heart. So I think you know, those visuals, I think, are never going to go away.
The song All Right became really an anthem of the Black Lives Matter movement in the days and weeks after Tamir Rice, this 12-year-old black boy in Cleveland carrying a toy gun, was shot and killed by police in 2015. This was something that happened sort of at the behest of fans. Why was it that song, do you think, that really spoke to that moment?
It wasn't necessarily a protest anthem until the protest in Cleveland.
Yeah.
It wasn't until after I think it was a Black Lives Matter meeting, I believe, and there was this young boy who gets on the bus and he's harassed by a police officer, and at this point, you know, emotions are very raw, especially in Cleveland because of the killing of Tamir, like you said, and so they, you know, one thing leads to another. They get in contact with the boy's mother, and he's released from custody, and somebody there starts chanting, "We gonna be all right." And then it was this thing. It became this groundswell where they're walking past police officers on guard, and they're walking through the streets chanting that. And that clip went viral. And that's when it became this thing where now you'd hear it in Baltimore, then you'd hear it, you know, in other places. And it became a protest anthem. But the funny thing about that song is that it wasn't meant to be a protest anthem. It was meant to be a local anthem. I remember Terrace Martin telling me specifically that they were more so taken by what was going on in LA, you know, and they were trying to talk to kids and peers in Los Angeles who may be struggling with, you know, gang activity or, you know, going in and out of jail, stuff like that. I think the overall impact of that song and the beauty of that song is the fact that it was really meant to talk to a local community, and it ended up being this global phenomenon. And now in the 2010s, it's considered possibly the best song of the 2010s.
When our pride was low, looking at the world like, where do we go? And we hate po-po, wanna kill us dead in the street for sure. I'm at the preacher's door, my knees getting weak and my gun might blow, but we gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright.
We gon' be alright. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gon' be alright. You know, it also speaks to the same thing that's going on with all of Kendrick's music, where everything is super, super personal, and it just connects with people because, for one, the music is good, and lyrically, he's, you know, talking a whole bunch. It just connects with a lot of different people.
My guest is Marcus Moore, music journalist, editor, curator, and pop culture commentator. He's the author of The Butterfly Effect, How Kendrick Lamar Ignited the Soul of Black America. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is Marcus Moore, music journalist, editor, curator, and pop culture commentator. He's the author of The Butterfly Effect, How Kendrick Lamar Ignited the Soul of Black America.
How did this project of reporting on Kendrick Lamar's life and work make you aware of the ways that he's wrestled with a kind of survivor's guilt?
You know, it's funny. Like, I've been a fan of Kendrick Lamar's for, like, the past decade. I still remember kind of stumbling onto Section 80 after seeing a positive review of it on Pitchfork. And, you know, it's one of those where I didn't realize how personal his music was until I went back and re-listened. Because it's easy to get caught up in the hype when something first come out and you're like, oh, man, this is just great. But then, you know, but you can't really explain why it's great. So the reason why I sort of figured and I knew that he was dealing with these things is because he would say it outright, and I didn't realize just how much, you know, and not until I reported the book, I didn't realize how much his albums are connected, especially Good Kid, To Pimp a Butterfly, and Damn. They're all connected in this way where, you know, he's striking the same tone on this album that he did on the last album, and this song is a continuation of this other thing from another record. And so it was this combination in reporting of, like, me listening very deeply, you know, because as a music journalist, I think my ears are sort of trained to listen to everything with this different level of consciousness. But also just, you know, old school reporting skills. When I thought that he was saying something on the thing, I would double check it. You know, I would ask Terrence, or I would ask, you know, whomever, and be like, hey, is he's saying this? Does he mean that? You know, because I didn't want to misrepresent anything he was doing with his art. And everybody told me the same thing, that, you know, look, even though his music, his lyrics are sort of they're hidden beneath this veneer of creativity, he's incredibly honest. And everything that he's talking about, he's either done or he's thought about or he's said in some form or another. So his music is very personal in that way. So in that regard, it was easy to report the book because he put everything out there. But again, you know, I also realized that this was the first book on Kendrick Lamar ever, and so the pressure was at its highest point. And I had to go above and beyond just to make sure that I wasn't putting words in his mouth.
You mentioned Twitter. I mean, he really doesn't have a constant presence on Twitter, on Insta, on social media. He doesn't appear to have a really large drive to, like, live publicly as a celebrity, you know, to be out and to be seen. Has he struggled with the trappings of fame at all?
I think that's the reason why he's not on social media, is because he doesn't want to get caught up in that stuff, because essentially that's what To Pimp a Butterfly was about. You know, all of a sudden, Good Kid, Mad City blows up. He's a famous guy. And now the people around you change. You know, now everybody wants you to do something. Everybody wants you to, you know, take part in this thing or be on this song. And so I think that ultimately, the reason why Kendrick is not on social media is because he's always been a shy guy. He's always been very, very shy. And that was even before he was this big time famous celebrity, you know, this all time transcendent rapper or musician too. It speaks to him as a kid and him being, you know, not necessarily comfortable with being out in public and being his full self in public. But he can be himself behind the scenes. Like everybody tells me, behind the scenes he's incredibly funny, he's incredibly engaging, but it's not until the cameras are on that he becomes like this really quiet, brooding kind of dude. Still personable, but you can tell the difference in his personality. And I wouldn't say that he's he's struggling with the trappings of fame. I do think that he's enjoying his success. And that he just, you know, so he comes from this old school where he just prefers to be a real person in real life and not necessarily put everything on Twitter and Facebook, because that stuff is not real. I know that we like to think it is, you know, we like to think that what's happening on Twitter is real life. He doesn't, you know, he's like this old school guy who's like, no, I'll talk to you on the telephone. I don't necessarily have to send you a DM. And I think that's more so his perspective.
You mentioned earlier that he was writing and rapping in some ways that resembled the greatest jazz virtuosos, maybe even before he really discovered jazz and put himself into studying it and understanding it and beginning to incorporate it into his work in a way nobody in hip hop had done before. What is his relationship to jazz, having worked it into some of his best songs?
He has a better relationship with it now, especially after or during the creation of To Pimp a Butterfly. Mm-hmm. Now, before then, he wasn't listening to jazz. He was listening to, you know, he was listening to old soul music. He listened to a lot of hip hop. But it wasn't until To Pimp a Butterfly comes around that he starts having this different relationship with jazz arrangements. And that's specifically because of Soundwave, and it's because of Terrace Martin. Both of those guys are jazz heads. Like Soundwave was playing Donald Byrd on the tour bus. And Kendrick, you know, is like, whoa, what is that? And he's like, oh yeah, this is Donald Byrd. You know, so just Kendrick being a curious person led him to liking jazz. And I remember that, you know, Terrace was telling me that one day he was playing some Latin jazz and he was playing some Willie Bobo in the studio, you know. And then Kendrick walks in and he's like, yo, what is that? We need some of that on the record. And so Kendrick more so, it hasn't become a jazz head. He just, he always is looking for different sounds. You know, I'm pretty sure if somebody was playing some rock music, he'd be like, oh, what's that? We need some of that. You know, like he just always searching for something different. So his relationship with jazz these days is a lot more, I would say it's a lot more natural. You know, I don't know if he's become a crate digger. I don't know if he's kind of falling down that wormhole because it's easy. I can attest to that. It's easy to fall down that jazz wormhole. I don't know if he's done that, but I do know that after Terrace essentially likened him to Herbie Hancock, that he started listening to jazz in a different way.
He's clearly comfortable. Kendrick Lamar is clearly comfortable taking risks in this drive to keep pushing himself and his work. Have those risks, those creative risks, ever failed since he started publishing, putting albums out on major labels?
Yeah. I remember the lead up to Pimp a Butterfly, and I can't put words in anybody else's mouth, but I do remember that at least between me and a few of my friends, like, we were kind of worried because each single was very different and none of them hit as hard as the singles of Good Kid, Mad City. So specifically, I remember it was 2014 and all the music at that time was really, really dark, and it was really aggressive because, in 2012, you had the killing of Trayvon Martin. And in 2014, you had mid 2014, Mike Brown gets killed. Mm-hmm. And so people are just upset. You have protests, you have uprisings like this generation had never seen. And then he comes out with a song called I, which at the time, the single version of it was just a straightforward loop of an old Isley Brothers record that was very upbeat and very sort of happy-go-lucky. Now, it wasn't until you dove into the lyrics that you realize that it's very self-affirming, and he's reclaiming his happiness because, again, he had been dealing with depression and survivor's guilt and being on the road, being away from his family. Everybody lack confidence. How many times my potential was anonymous? How many times the city making me promises? So I promise this. I love myself. The world is a ghetto, big guns and dicky signs. I love myself. But at the time, people were not trying to hear that, and it just didn't fit the tone. And then at the same time, I can't remember if it was before or after, but the Black of the Berry comes out, which is a great song. But then it gets to that third verse that essentially gets into some respectability politics where he's like, well, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but it's just like, okay, things are going bad out here. Cops are killing people who look like me, but why, what about gang activity? What about us? That kind of thing. And I remember that there was a very sharp reaction to that too. It's funny how Zulu and Thosa might go to war. Two tribal armies that want to build and destroy. Remind me of these Compton Crip gangs that live next door. Beefing with power rules, only death settled the score. So no matter how much I say I like to preach with the Panthers, or tell Georgia State Marcus Garvey got all the answers, or try to celebrate February like it's my B-Day, or eat watermelon chicken and Kool-Aid on weekdays, or jump high enough to get Michael Jordan endorsements, or watch BET because urban support is important. So why did I weep when Trayvon Martin was in the street, when gangbanging make me kill a blacker than me? And I think those two singles in particular kind of showed us like, Good Kid, Mad City was popular. Is he just now gonna sort of revel in this fame and do something different, or what's gonna happen? And so it's easy to gloss over that stuff now because it all ended well, but at the time there was a very clear concern that we had lost this guy already. He had only come out with one record, and maybe he was just gonna spend his money and just be, he was gonna go back to some K-Dot stuff or something. We didn't know. So I would say those are the very, just at least musically, those were the two big missteps that I can remember.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You can use art to hold a mirror to society. You can use art to provide an escape. How does Kendrick think about the purpose of his music?
He wants it to be honest, and he wants it to speak to a segment of the population that doesn't get the shine or the recognition or the attention that it deserves. So ultimately, Kendrick makes his music for his community. He's always going to do that. He's always going to make music for Compton. He's going to make it for Los Angeles. He's going to make it for kids who grew up like him, who are sort of struggling to make it, who want to make it but don't know how to get out of their circumstances. And I feel like he's always wrestled with that. You know, he's always given music to people who don't know how to express themselves, you know, in the same way that he does. And I feel like whatever he creates is going to be that. You know, I feel like his most personal record, aside from Good Kid, Mad City, is probably Damn as well, because that's when you get the full-on Kendrick West, like, okay, I'm good now, I'm financially secure, I've won all these awards, I'm doing okay, but now I'm wrestling with my faith, I'm wrestling with who can I trust, I'm wrestling with, you know, isolation. So I feel like his music is always this perfect combination of introspection and outward looking musings, you know, outward looking messages. And I believe that if he keeps that same formula, and there's no telling where he's going to go next, but I feel like that's always going to be the formula for his records.
You built this book out of in-depth conversations you had with people who have known Kendrick Lamar very well throughout his life. I wonder, is there anything his friends and peers and mentors seem to still wonder about him that they haven't figured out about Kendrick Lamar?
They're still trying to figure out if he's happy, you know, like if he's fully happy with everything that's going on, if he's fully comfortable. Because like we were saying earlier, like when you're a perfectionist, there's a certain level of misery that comes with being a perfectionist, because you're always in your head and you're always thinking about the next thing. You're always thinking about the next project, and you're thinking about how to make it great. Soundwave always talks about how, you know, as soon as they click send on one album, he's already back like, okay, for this next album, I want to do this. And it's like, wait, hold on. Like, we had this one hasn't come out yet. Like, but no, they're going to get that one. Let's talk about how we're going to, you know, make this one even better. And, you know, by the time Damn comes around, they're sleeping in sleeping bags in the studio, and they're, you know, in the car doing the car test and making sure that it sounded perfect. So I say all that to say that his friends and his family, they love the guy, and you know, obviously they would, but they do wonder if he's ultimately happy or comfortable with everything that's happened for him, because there is a part of him that still has this disbelief that, man, like, I did all of this, and wow, like, all this stuff happened to me. This is crazy. So I don't think he's ever going to get beyond that, because people who put the art first and people who create with such heart are always going to be that way, where, you know, you'll have these moments of happiness and of calm and peace, but ultimately you just want to put your heart out there and you want to be even more creative than you were before. And that's the thing that I feel like his friends and family sort of check in on him about. And that's part of the reason, too, why he's so invisible in between records, is because, you know, he has to step away from that stuff because his art is so meticulous that I can't imagine how exhausted he must be whenever he's finished, because he's putting so much into it.
Marcus Moore is a music journalist, editor, curator, and pop culture commentator. He's the author of The Butterfly Effect: How Kendrick Lamar Ignited the Soul of Black America.
Marcus, thank you so much for talking with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. And subscribe to our podcast free wherever you get podcasts. Just search for KERAThink. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.